tender vessel that sinks in the middle of the night under circumstances where there's no storm suggests pretty strongly that somebody screwed up.
Bristol Bay set netters sue over losses stemming from the Lone Star oil spill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an innovative, affordable housing model for Anchorage.
It works better as a community to have a mixture of all Anchorage residents living in one area as opposed to kind of separating things out.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
A group of Bristol Bay fishermen have filed suit against Trident Seafoods, Magone Marine Services, and the owner and operator of the vessel Lone Star, which sank in the Agushik River during the middle of this past year's salmon fishery. The resulting oil spill shut down the fishery, costing most Agushik Beach set netters their season. They say they have still not been paid for their lost income for the season. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The 78-foot vessel Lone Star sat at anchor in the Agushik River during the evening of June 30th. When the tide changed, it's believed the vessel swung around on its anchor line. The anchor line ripped the transducer from the hull. The Lone Star took on water, capsized, and sank in the shallow water of the river. At the time, the vessel had nearly 14,000 gallons of diesel on board, as well as several hundred gallons of other petroleum products and roughly 35,000 pounds of salmon that had yet to be delivered. Fish and Game shut down the nearby set net fishery at the first sight of an oily sheen. Most of those fishermen never got their nets back in the water last season, but were instead given a number to an insurance company they were told would make good on losses, hopefully before it was time to buy fuel for the winter months.
We haven't seen a red cent from the insurance company.
That's Larry Bartman of Manicotic, whose family has been fishing from their cabin on Agushik Beach for decades. Most of the Agushik fishing families hail from Manicotic. Bartman has not joined the lawsuit that 20 or so others have, but he thinks more will add their names as plaintiffs if remittances don't come some other way, and soon.
I would think so. I mean, if people aren't getting any compensation of any sort, I think that would be the next course of action that most people would take, but I couldn't say for sure.
Representing the plaintiffs in the lawsuit are the attorneys Myron Anksman of Bethel and Adam and Russell Winter of Winter & Associates in Anchorage. The lawsuit alleges in no uncertain terms that Lone Star vessel owner Charles Barisi and his crew are at fault for the sinking and that Trident Seafoods is responsible because it employed the Lone Star as a tender for the season. Attorney Russell Winter says the defendant's actions constitute negligence and gross negligence.
Well, I think it almost goes without saying that a tender vessel that's anchored in the, you know, at the mouth of the Agushik River and sinks in the middle of the night under circumstances where there's no storm suggests pretty strongly that somebody screwed up.
The lawsuit also alleges negligence on the part of Magone Marine Service and the Resolve Marine Group, both of whom were involved in the months-long effort that eventually hoisted the Lone Star out of the mud and towed it to Unalaska. But according to the plaintiffs, the salvagers botched one big final step after the vessel was floated.
Large amount of salmon sludge or waste was either dumped or released, and it washed up onto the beaches right in front of set net cabins,
which the suit says attracted a large number of bears. And when those bears finished eating the salmon waste washing up along the beach, their attention was turned to the nearby cabins, now empty for the season. Larry Bartman in Manicotic says damage was done to cabins up and down the beach, something he's never seen in the past.
Yeah, a lot of cabins were broken into, including mine, where a bear just ripped through a wall of our cabin and he left a mess.
Citing income losses from the past season and potential losses to future seasons, lost subsistence use, and property damage, the plaintiffs are seeking damages in excess of $100,000 each. The attorneys say this could get settled out of court any time or could take years of litigation. Trident Seafoods did not respond to a request for comment by our deadline. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska's congressional delegation is bracing for an FDA decision on genetically modified salmon, and Senator Mark Begich has asked the head of the agency not to exploit the holiday season to release what's expected to be an unpopular report. At issue is a U.S. company's plan to create Atlantic salmon eggs for fish farms that include a Chinook salmon gene. Aqua Bounty hopes to produce fish that grow to market size in half the time. Senator Begich calls it frankenfish.
The FDA has never approved anything of this nature, which is basically cloning. And from that perspective, I think they're not prepared to understand the potential long-term impacts.
Last year, on the day after Christmas, the FDA officially announced its initial ruling in favor of gene-modified salmon. Begich says it seemed they were trying to slip something by when Americans weren't looking. An FDA spokeswoman, though, says they publish documents when they're complete. In a letter last week, Begich asked that they avoid such surprises this season, and he says they assured him the document isn't coming soon.
You know, at least they've responded, which is a good sign that they recognize how important this issue is, and that they can't just rush it through at the end of the year because they want to.
Nearly 38,000 people wrote comments to the FDA about Aqua Bounty's plan. Almost all were against it. Begich, like Alaska fishermen, says the modified salmon could escape and damage the state's wild stocks, and he says they'd hurt Alaska salmon in the marketplace. Aqua Bounty says its fish will be sterile and reared inland in Panama, so they can't escape and harm natural populations. Canada last month cleared the firm to produce genetically modified salmon eggs for commercial use at its hatchery on Prince Edward Island. Wood is a primary heating fuel in the interior, but the practice of burning less than dry logs often results in elevated fine particulate pollution in the Fairbanks area. A local business has a solution. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
North Pole-based manufacturer Superior Pellet Fuels is out with a new product to compete with traditional birch and spruce cordwood.
A wood pellet log.
That's Superior Pellet Fuels general manager Chad Schumacher. Schumacher introduced the product to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, describing the 3-inch diameter compressed sawdust logs as energy-packed.
It has an extremely low moisture content of 8% or less, and the density of this product is between 80 and 85 pounds per cubic foot.
20% moisture is considered the target for clean-burning natural firewood. Schumacher said the pellet log's much lower water content enables them to burn hotter and cleaner. He said the high-density pellet logs also take up just 1/7 of the storage space of cordwood and cost less.
You're looking at a per-cord price of $150 a cord.
You can easily pay twice that for a cord of wood in Fairbanks. Superior Pellet Fuels has been turning sawdust and other waste wood into fuel for specialized pellet stoves out of a plant off the Richardson Highway since 2010. Schumacher says pellet sales have quadrupled, but the company wants to tap the market for conventional wood stove fuel. He anticipates having the pellet logs available this month. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
An Alaska prison inmate is in an Anchorage hospital tonight, according to Alaska State Troopers, following an assault by a fellow inmate. The alleged assault happened on Friday evening. A corrections officer at Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward called it in. Troopers say Jason Rack, age 25, assaulted another inmate, Forrest Akavana, age 48. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says Akavana was beaten, but it is not certain if a weapon was used. Peters says troopers believe the attack was planned. Casey Schroeder, spokesperson for the State Department of Corrections, did not return calls, but Brad Wilson with the Alaska Correctional Officers Association says the incident is indicative of understaffing at state corrections institutions. Spring Creek has had previous disturbances. In October of 2012, inmates assaulted a corrections officer, and in August of this year, more than a dozen inmates faced disciplinary action after they destroyed toilets and sinks in their cells. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juno rock slide onto a frozen lake perplexes scientists.
It's a very, very interesting physics problem. And I am asking people that are geekier than I am to look at this.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained Quit Coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The state-owned housing agency is trying something innovative to increase access to affordable housing in Anchorage. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is developing mixed housing in East Anchorage that will combine low-income apartments with regular ones. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Tucked between a trailer park and the Glen Square Mall along Mountain View Drive are 6.5 acres of property with a view of the Chugach Range. A 70-unit apartment complex will soon be built here. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation CEO Brian Butcher says it's the beginning of what he hopes is a new direction for the organization.
The great thing about this location is the city of Anchorage is really pretty land poor when it comes to developing housing. And you can find scattered areas all over the place, but there's really not a lot of room to build housing. So to find a piece of property of this size that can be developed to this extent in an area so central to downtown Anchorage, as well as the Mountain View area, we're really fortunate to have, and we're really excited about this being the kickoff of this kind of development in Anchorage.
Butcher steps out onto what's right now an empty swath of land covered by snow. He says the development is needed in Anchorage.
We're especially excited about the affordable housing part of it because Anchorage and, frankly, the entire state of Alaska is so short on affordable housing. It's very difficult for folks to find housing. So being able to add 70 new units of housing stock to the city of Anchorage, we think is tremendous.
The apartments will be near employment centers, around the corner from a bus stop, and within walking distance of Clark Middle School. Butcher says it's the first in a series of upcoming projects that will step away from the failing model of separating where poor people live from where everyone else does.
Used to be there'd be a focus on public housing or lower income housing, and it works better as a community to have it mixed and have a mixture of all Anchorage residents living in one area as opposed to kind of separating things out.
At any given time, there's just a 1-2% vacancy rate on rentals in the city, and the average two-bedroom apartment goes for more than $1,000 a month. Mark Romick is the director of planning for AHFC. He says the project, which is the first development by the agency's new nonprofit subsidiary, will save money. Romick says with federal and state funds dwindling, the agency is looking for new ways to access money and moving toward more projects that are paid for through public-private partnerships.
There are federal tax credits that are provided by the Treasury to projects where the private sector is investing in the development of low-income housing. And so Alaska Housing, through its subsidiary, will be a general partner in a limited partnership with a private investor.
Michael Courtney is director of operations for AHFC. He says the organization is working with local businesses and community organizations to make sure the developments meet the needs of residents and fit into neighborhoods.
One of the other things about AHFC is we try very hard to be a good neighbor, fit well into the neighborhoods. So we've been working with the Anchorage Community Land Trust. We've been attending the Mountain View Community Council meetings, talking to businessmen in the community to make sure that this property is going to work in with their employees, with the area and the neighborhood.
The Mountain View development comes at a time when the AHFC is for the first time putting a 5-year time limit on able-bodied residents. Courtney says the Anchorage development and others like it will help those working to get out of public housing in the area find something that they can afford once they graduate from the program.
It just increases the housing opportunity in Anchorage and gives people more choices in areas that they might want to be in.
Future developments could also include some commercial properties for coffee shops, cafes, and retail on the street level. The total for the Mountain View project is around $27 million. It's set for construction in 2014. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Juneau Animal Control is investigating two recent dog attacks in the capital city. KTOO's Casey Kelly has the story of a woman and her dog attacked last week by three pit bulls and the doctor who came to their rescue.
About 4 o'clock last Wednesday afternoon, Bridget Kuhar and her dog Otis set out for a walk near Bartlett Regional Hospital. Kuhar is a yoga teacher and musician. Her husband and bandmate George was playing music that afternoon at Wildflower Court Nursing Home. Kuhar had just brought him his guitar.
The dog hadn't really been for a walk that day, and I was going to walk from Wildflower Court down to Twin Lakes and back and go home.
It was a clear, cold day, and the sun was beginning to set. Otis is an 11-year-old black mutt. He was on a leash and walking with Kuhar on the sidewalk near the intersection of Salmon Creek Lane and Hospital Drive. Kuhar says she noticed three dogs across the street behind some sort of gate or fence. The next thing she knew, they were running toward her.
It happened very fast. You know, I just was like trying to figure out what to do if they did come over because I knew they were going to attack my dog. I mean, they just had that posture about them.
Kuhar says her first instinct was to turn away. She and Otis stepped off of the sidewalk, but the other dogs were already on top of them.
I started screaming and I wanted to stay on my feet. You know, I tried to stay on my feet to use my legs to kick and punch the dogs. Two of them went for his head and one went for his back.
She says they all ended up in a ditch on the side of the road, rolling around in the snow. All three of the other dogs were pit bulls. Their owner was the first to arrive to help, but there was little either of them could do. Kuhar says she tried to protect Otis as best she could.
I was fighting two dogs on his head. I was losing, for sure. There wasn't really any fighting I was doing. It was like hitting cinder blocks.
By this point, a few people in cars were stopping to try and help. One of them was Dr. Lindy Jones, a physician at nearby Valley Medical Center.
Initially was very overwhelmed at the viciousness of this whole scene, particularly how these dogs were just trying to rip the dog apart.
Eventually, Jones was able to help Kuhar get the two dogs off of Otis's head. The owner of the pit bulls was able to get the third dog to release as well, and Kuhar, Jones, and Otis all ran to Jones's car.
I took her up to my clinic. She was bleeding from her hand. The dog was bleeding from multiple puncture wounds. Yeah, it was definite carnage.
Kuhar went to the emergency room at Bartlett, where she was treated for bite wounds to her right hand and forearm. Otis spent the night at the vet's, but was able to come home the next day.
He's really chewed up, but there's no major damage to his internal organs.
Juno Animal Control cited the owners of the three pit bulls for the incident, but declined to identify them. Kuhar says she doesn't know who the owners are, but says they agreed to pay her medical bills and Otis's vet bill. She says she's thankful to the owner who helped pull one of the dogs off Otis and to Jones for his heroics.
Certainly without Lindy interfering, my dog would be dead. I might be dead too.
Kuhar says she doesn't want to get involved in the debate over whether pit bulls are dangerous. Jones says he hadn't thought much about the issue before the event. Now, he says it certainly has shaped his opinion.
A responsible pet owner should consider whether or not it's appropriate to have three potentially vicious dogs by themselves. Because I think the ability of one individual to control three vicious dogs of this is nearly impossible, as we've experienced here. I mean, the guy who owned them could not even control one of them.
Gastineau Humane Society Executive Director Hava Lee says the pit bull's owners will have to meet certain requirements for public safety. That includes signs on their property warning of the dog's dangerous status, special collars, leashes, and muzzles, as well as possibly having to get the animals fixed. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A slide that sent rocks crashing onto frozen Mendenhall Lake in late November actually caused a small tsunami. It also posed a scientific question as well as concern that rock slides are another unpredictable hazard for people exploring the frozen lake during this winter. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
Apparently no one witnessed the rock slide, but Thanksgiving Day hikers on Nugget Falls Trail reported seeing jumbled piles of ice tossed by waves onto the beach. Refrozen ice plates 6 to 8 inches thick can still be seen on the lake. Laurie Craig is a naturalist at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center.
The first thing I noticed was that there was broken lake ice on one side, and then there was broken lake ice on another side.
With no evidence of glacier calving, Craig says trying to figure out what happened turned into a real sleuthing job.
Geologic forensics.
A scope of Ballard Mountain showed evidence of a rock slide. Then tree limbs were seen in the rubble ice.
We could clearly see evidence of where this narrow band of rocks cascaded down off the mountainside and broke the lake ice that was right up against it. And then it reverberated under the lake and hit against rock on the other side, which broke there as well.
How does that happen? If the rocks had hit water, there'd be a big splash and the wave would travel across the lake. That's simple enough. Now, add a layer of ice. Craig posed the question on Friday to Joel Curtis, warning and coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Juneau.
How does the water pop up on the other side of the lake under the ice? Let's say the ice is thicker out in the middle. It's a very, very interesting physics problem, and I am asking people that are geekier than I am to look at this.
One of the scientists he consulted was Dr. Aaron Hood at the University of Alaska Southeast, a hydrologist and glaciologist. The two came up with this.
The answer is that the wave that was formed propagated right along with the ice, although the wave was dampened because it had to lift the ice. But it still was enough to get across Mendenhall Lake and have water squirt out on the other side.
Technically, Curtis says, it was like a small tsunami. And the takeaway? Ice is not as rigid as most people think. While the ice on Mendenhall Lake may look stable, Curtis says it is not. Definitely avoid the face of the glacier, ice caves, creeks, icebergs, and the area where the lake flows into Mendenhall River.
And, of course, the freeze-thaw cycle can cause rock slides on any of the steep slopes. We all love the lake and really love going out there, but you have to be safe when you do.
On January 11th, the U.S. Forest Service and Capital City Fire and Rescue will hold ice safety training and demonstrations at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Recently, Alaska's Board of Fisheries set up an experimental harvest in the Aleutian Islands that they thought might benefit small communities like Adak. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, Adak had their eyes on a much bigger prize.
Atka mackerel move fast and live low. They're strong swimmers that like to hide along rocky sea bottoms, and in the Aleutians especially, they can be tough to catch. But Orville Huntington, a member of the Alaska Board of Fisheries from Huslia, thought it was worth a shot. At a meeting this fall, Huntington told the board he supported a plan to shift a tiny amount of Atka mackerel quota into the Aleutians. He said it could be good for fishermen and for residents of communities like Adak.
Seems to me that this does give an opportunity for Alaskan citizens to at least try something new.
The board bumped up the catch amount to encourage more fishermen to participate, and they approved the new small boat harvest for mackerel. It seemed like good news for Adak. The island's economy is dependent on its seafood processing plant, and they've wanted to branch out for a while, just not into mackerel. Dave Frazier is a board member of the nonprofit Adak Community Development Corporation, or ECDC. Frazier helped them campaign to get the new mackerel fishery struck down and to improve their chances of getting a federal pollock harvest approved.
We were concerned that shifting 10% of the mackerel quota into critical habitat would have had consequences in terms of the ability of nymph protected resources to approve the pollock fishery in the Aleutians.
Mackerel and pollock are both big food sources for Steller sea lions, an endangered species that the National Marine Fisheries Service has gone to great lengths to protect. For years, they closed down commercial fishing in big swaths in the Aleutians. but that might be about to change. NIMS has been working on a court-ordered study of their sea lion protections all year. As part of that, they've been examining ways to safely open up more fishing grounds in the Aleutians, including the spot where ADAC wants to fish a small amount of pollock quota. Fraser says they got the allocation years ago for the purpose of helping ADAC grow.
If it's open, that would allow access to roughly 19,000 tons of pollock, which would be a huge benefit to the corporation and to the community of ADAC.
That's because even a small amount of pollock is worth a lot of money, more than the mackerel fishery that the state set up. And even though NIMS is considering more fishing right now, it wasn't clear if they'd support two new fisheries on sea lion food sources, mackerel and pollock, in an area that's still important habitat. So in late November, ACDC filed a petition with the Board of Fish to take back their mackerel vote. The board called an emergency meeting and asked a NIMS biologist to come in and clarify the agency's thinking. Nicole Kimball told the board that NIMS probably wouldn't want to allow fishing for both mackerel and pollock.
So for instance, this pollock fishery that is potentially on the table and potentially could be allowable under this new biological opinion may not be on the table as a worst-case scenario under this action.
Several Board of Fish members said it wasn't their intent to preclude a pollock harvest, and it wasn't worth it to put mackerel first. So after consulting with a lawyer, they voted unanimously to take back the mackerel fishery. Fraser says there's been no harm done to ACDC's goal, as far as they know.
It was an action by the board with the best of intentions, with unintended consequences.
Now that they've ironed out what new fishery gets precedent in the area, ADAC still has to wait for NIMS to release a draft of their biological study on sea lion protections. That should arrive in late winter. Then ADAC will have a better idea of when or if they might be able to catch pollock, a resource they'd still be sharing with the sea lions. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And finally tonight, we have a correction. In a story we aired last week about ethics violations for Representative Bob Herron, we mistakenly reported that Herron is being fined by the House Ethics Committee. The Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC, is the only organization that has levied a fine against Representative Herron. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Casey Kelly and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.